Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Politics and Polemics, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Megu. I also host my own podcasts, Independent Thought and Freedom, and also A Story Club, Global Politics and Global Cultures. Today, my guest is Ian Murray, author of the book The Socialist Temptation, published by Regnery Gateway, out now in hardcover and on Kindle. Welcome, Ian.
It's great to be with you today, Kirk.
Thanks. I'm glad to have you on as well. By the way, I'm coming from sunny and too hot Trinidad and Tobago right now. Where are you located, right?
I'm located in sunny and too hot Virginia, Northern Virginia, United States.
Okay. Great. Well, for our listeners that might not know about your background or whatnot, could you please tell us a bit about yourself, and particularly as it relates to this book?
Absolutely. I'd be very happy to. I grew up in the industrial northeast of England in the late 60s, early 70s. England in those days was a socialist state. It was a democratic socialist state. Things had been nationalized and bureaucratized after the Second World War. And as a result, Britain's economy had started to get into the doldrums. We were faced with, in the early 70s, a series of strikes by power workers and the miners. In fact, my grandfather was a miners' union official. As a result of that, I realized very early on that there might be something wrong with this system when I had to do my my homework by candlelight in the 1970s.
Right.
And after that, I became a supporter of Margaret Thatcher and her beliefs that the frontiers of the state needed to be rolled back and Britain needed to be freed from its socialist burden. And I was involved in politics at university. I knew Boris Johnson quite well. And then in the 1990s, I worked for the British government, helped privatize the British rail system, and privatized myself out of a job. That happened when I was at university. I had met a lovely young American girl. And so with the redundancy settlement I got from privatizing myself out of a job, I came to the United States. For the past 20 years, I have been working at a couple of free market organizations. For the past 17, at the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C.
Okay, well, that's very interesting, and it takes you across both the the political landscapes of both the UK and the US. When you arrived in the US to live, who was president?
It was Bill Clinton at the time. Of course, Bill Clinton was very much a centrist Democrat whose policies aren't really being followed by the current Democrats.
Right, right. Yes, and a bit like New Labour in Britain, that kind of third way. Yeah, I think these things are important for us to touch on later. But let's deal with the central argument of your book and the title itself, The Socialist Temptation. So can you explain what you mean by the socialist temptation and why it is important?
Well, as I was suggesting earlier, when Britain and a lot of other countries in Europe, Sweden is a prime example, turned away from democratic socialism in the 80s and 90s, and of course we saw the Berlin Wall come down in 1990, we saw the socialist parties of Europe and the United States, the left-wing party in the United States, head towards a belief in free markets. I thought that socialism was gone. And then in the past decade or so, it has reared its head again. And because I was aware of the internal contradictions of socialism, and I thought that these had become generally accepted, generally part of received wisdom, I was curious as to why people were turning to socialism. And so I wrote The Socialist Temptation to try to answer that question. Why are people turning to socialism? And I realized that it's because socialism does a very good job of talking at the values level, the values that underpin our politics. And it says to people that in America's case, for example, it says to people that America isn't perfect. In America, you're supposed to believe in fairness and freedom and community, but the current system does not has been very bad for all those three values. Socialism provides an answer to those. So come and join us in the socialist. On the socialist side of things. So I wanted to explore a bit more why it appeals so much to those values.
Yeah, that's a very interesting and it speaks to me a lot as well. I'll tell you a story about myself, and I think it may apply to a lot of persons, perhaps yourself, given your background. But I actually grew up in Toronto and, you know, had a very liberal education. You know, in Canada, the Liberal Party is the kind of the natural party of government and in being in a big city and whatnot. So the whole idea when I was growing up was, you know, if you were a smart, intelligent, caring, socially conscious person, you know, well-read, liked to read, there was no question that you would be a liberal, and that the conservatives were, you know, greedy, selfish, people who didn't read, who didn't like culture, you know. So there's a difference between European conservatism in that way, there's this prejudice against conservatives and conservatism, and that whole point that socialism was so good at speaking to values is incredibly important. And in fact, when I was a university student during the sort of Thatcherite revolution, so in the 1980s and Reaganites, and you know, I had commitments, let's say, ideological commitments to social justice and these sorts of things, and the Reaganites and Thatcherites at the time, you know, even poo-pooed all those things, you know, that, oh, well, why would you hold such values? It's just self-interest is the only thing, you know. The whole idea of greed is good, which was popularized in the movie Wall Street, so that whole caricature of the right conservatives being only concerned about one's own well-being and not concerned about social well-being really sort of hit the right hard for people who did not follow that. Since you were on that side in the 1980s, because I can tell you, you know, how I subsequently left, but I don't want to necessarily get into that. I want to more get into to your own thing, because I think it's interesting that you come from the northeastern England. I did my PhD up in Hull in Yorkshire, so kind of familiar with the area, and that whole milieu and a lot of working class people that went across to Thatcherism. I'm presuming you were one of those people, and I'd like to hear your own personal thought process in that, because I think it's very important to your argument you're making.
Well, indeed, one of the things that struck me when I was listening to my parents discussing things when I was in my early teens was that there seemed to be a ruling class in at least in the area of Britain that I grew up in that wasn't dukes and landed gentry and so on. It was people who had very, very tight connections to the labor unions. My father would tell me that when he went to try to get a job as an apprentice electrician, he was told that he couldn't because he wasn't a member of the union. And he asked, "Well, how do I become a member of the union?" They said, "Well, you have to have a job as an apprentice electrician." And so he was sort of caught in that. In that cycle for a while of not being able to get a job and the training that he needed to get. Meanwhile, my mother, who was a deputy head teacher, deputy principal, vice principal in the American terminology, she kept going for jobs as head teachers, but she would know when she went into the interview room and saw the other people who were waiting for the interview, she would know that she wouldn't get it because she knew that the people she was up against had tighter connections with the teachers' union and the local council than she did. So I found that what was happening to my parents was extremely unfair. And I wanted to this new ruling class that had been set up to be shaken and reformed, and that's one of the reasons why I became a Thatcherite. Then I went to university, and very interestingly, Oxford in the 1980s seemed to be very similar to some of the stories that we've heard out of American campuses recently. When I joined the Conservative Association at Oxford, I was one of only 10 members of the Conservative Association at my college, Oxford had collegiate system, and there were 600 people in my college. So only 10 of those 600 were conservatives. We were viewed as freaks.
Could I ask you one thing as well? Your parents, how did your parents and your family react to you becoming a Thatcherite? Were they supportive or not?
My mother was supportive. My father was always a little suspicious of being too closely associated with the capitalists, as he my mother had become a conservative, I think, as a result of her experiences as well.
Okay, right. So you were talking about being regarded as a freak at Oxford for being one of these sort of young conservatives, was it?
Yes, indeed. At my college, the main question was not are you on the left, but are you a Trotskyite or a Stalin?
Right. Yes, yes. Which faction and what intra-left faction? Yes, that's absolutely brilliant because it fits in so much into what I observe, and I think many others, that the left has its own forms of racism, of classism, of elitism, and in fact, it's quite anti-working class in practice. I think it's Thomas Piketty, talked about the Brahmin left now. There's urban Ivy League educated elites, and in fact, they're culturally Marxist now because they've basically abandoned the working people, do you agree with that observation? Do you see that in your own survey of the landscape?
Yeah, oh, I think that's very clear. I think that at least in Britain and the US, the parties that would previously be called the People's Parties have very much abandoned at least certain elements of the working class. That's not the case everywhere. If you look at Denmark, for instance, the Social Democrats in Denmark have actually become quite nationalist and have retained the support of the working class as a result. But I think in Britain and the US, you know, it's very much now a question of education and background. If you're college educated, you are expected to be on the left these days, which is a big change from even the 1980s.
Yes, yes, very much. So what is the main argument of your book that as to why socialism is so much embraced by young people, by the establishment today, and the arguments that seemed to be won in the 1990s are almost in a sense being replayed now?
I draw on something, a field of study called cultural cognition studies. So under cultural cognition theory, there are these three main value groups. The first is egalitarianism. Fundamental value for fundamental virtue for the egalitarian is fairness. Things must be seen to be fair, and socialism has done a very good job of talking about fairness, particularly recently when it comes to racial and gender fairness. The whole concept of privilege that has come to be so important in our national discourse is fundamentally about fairness. Then there's, for want of a better term, the libertarian value group, for whom freedom is the primary virtue. It would seem that at first glance that socialism would have nothing to offer here. But then, when you look at socialism and its rhetoric, one of the most time-honored socialist phrases is "Workers of the world unite! You have nothing to lose but your chains." There is a whole tradition of socialism that talks about freedom in terms of agency, and that you cannot have agency unless you are freed from exploitation by your employer and by the church and other things. And having a strong socialist state actually gives you that agency. So socialism is able to talk in terms of freedom. And of course, it's also able to talk in terms of community. There is while some might think that conservatives have that one locked up, socialism, especially in its American form, has painted this rosy picture of a golden age in the 1950s when labor unions were extremely strong and that there were high tax rates to make sure that people didn't get too disconnected with their community. And if only we could get back to that sort of set of policies, then community would be strengthened and freed from the depredations of the capitalists who just want to destroy community. And so socialism has done an extremely good job, I think, of reinserting itself into the national discourse by talking at this values-based level, when at the same time, those of us on the free enterprise side and on the conservative side, we've done a very bad job of that. We've forgotten how to talk in terms of values, and this is one of the reasons why there's currently a falling out between free market libertarians and social conservatives, because both of those have forgotten how to talk to each other, because they've forgotten how to talk to each other in terms of values, and as a result, socialism has a lot of room to grow in America, precisely because it talks to those values.
Right. Yeah. Andrew Breitbart, I know, and others, but he was prominent in the United States in particular, often talked about culture and how, the culture, I think the term was culture is upstream from politics, that the culture determines a politics. And I remember the culture of the 1980s when I was a student, and like in Britain you had like Billy Bragg and who was opening for the coal miners, and it was cool, it was hip, and this sort of stuff, whereas the right never had that type of cachet in the same way. I suppose Hollywood in America might have been on the side of the sort of jingoistic right with like Top Gun and Rambo and stuff like that, but certainly the left seems to have gotten that culture part down to it. How much do you see these kind of culture wars and I guess cultural products and this type of thing as important to your argument?
They're not a main part of my argument, but it is extremely important. You talked about Billy Bragg. At the same time, in Britain, the alternative comedy appeared,
right?
And the whole idea of that was to poke fun at the establishment. And
like Spitting Image, you're talking about?
Like Spitting Image, like Ben Elton, that who went on to be to write the Blackadder series and so on. And this idea that the comedy had to be political, and that has now taken over comedy, I think, completely on both sides of the Atlantic. Comedy Central is probably one of the most political networks there is.
Absolutely.
So I think this has helped create a culture which has weakened many of the institutions that previously supported the free enterprise system. In the Socialist Temptation, I talk, for instance, about the phenomenon of woke capitalism. I don't think that we would have the phenomenon of woke capitalism if the culture had not been taken over to the extent it has been.
Right. Now, if we get to the organization of your book, it's many short chapters. It's a popular focused book. You have 44 chapters arranged into 5 sections. Socialism, a myth that refuses to die. Can socialism deliver a fair society? Does socialism free the individual? Can socialism sustain communities? A temptation America can't afford to indulge. So in a sense, you're taking the argument, I suppose, you're rationally dissembling the myths and ideas that make socialism attractive. Is that a correct way to think of what you're doing here?
Yes, I think that's a very fair way of putting it. What I attempt to do is to show why socialism would appear attractive, and then to try and point out the contradictions of socialism that lead to it not sustaining those values, but actually undermining those values. How socialism actually leads to institutional unfairness with the creation of a new ruling class. How socialism abrogates freedoms in order to say that people are free, and how socialism in the end destroys communities rather than sustains them. And that's why I finish off by saying that this is the temptation that America just cannot afford to indulge.
Right. When you would have come in to the Conservative Party, I suppose as part of a new group, in a sense, of working class people coming in. I'm sure that there were before, but Thatcher really brought in this new dynamism into the Conservative Party. I would imagine you would have faced off some other people in the Conservative Party, because they're obviously different wings. You know, some sort of the more sort of blue bloods and kind of aristocratic ones, and then maybe at a certain point, definitely the Thatcherites would have been seen as some sort of upstarts. Were the battles within the Conservatives in those days something similar and relevant to what you're seeing today? Because, you know, just as you're talking about how, you know, in the 50s and 60s, even conservative regimes or Republican in the United States, you know, had high tax rates, much higher than, you know, emerged after the Thatcher-Reagan revolutions. Could you just let me know whether you think those debates were relevant to today and what they were?
Oh yes, I think that was very clearly what was up. To use the jargon of the time, my faction in conservative politics at university was very much made up of northerners who mostly of modest origin. Either lower middle class or middle class in the British versions of that of
class,
that.
Yeah.
Our opponents on the what we would call the wet side of politics were very much of the upper middle class or even upper class persuasion, as it were. They strongly believed in paternalism as being vitally important, whereas we believed in those of us on the dry side of politics, of conservative politics, believed in aspiration as the most important. And so, in some ways, that's the argument that has resurfaced. In American politics, between paternalists who believe that there is a role for government in determining the industrial policy of the nation, but I don't think that it's class based now, as a lot of the working class, middle class in American terminology. Support for some conservative politicians like Josh Hawley and Tom Cotton is based around a paternalist idea that the government can actually help direct things. It's a different makeup of the of the debate, but it is essentially the same debate.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Okay. In your book, you have a chapter in the first part, the early section, where you talk about socialism in American history. I'd like you to expound on it a bit, because since you're coming from both the U.S. and UK context in terms of your understanding of the phenomenon, there are significant differences between socialism in American history and socialism in UK history, and so I'd like to hear your argument about socialism in American history, given that context?
Well, one of the most interesting things I found, and this was something that surprised me utterly because of the experiences of my youth, which I explained earlier, was that labor unions in America rejected socialism very early on. Samuel Gompers, for instance, the founder of the American Federation of Labor, repudiated socialism, said it just wouldn't work. And said that that labor unions weren't about imposing socialism, which they were in Western Europe. They were about making sure that people got the labor unions got the best deal for their members. And this was quite eye opening to me to see the labor unions were actually strongly in favor of free enterprise and resisted socialism because they realized that having they were to be part of a sharing process, sharing of profits. The labor unions would use their bargaining power to make sure that they had the best deal possible for their members. And that meant that they needed a strong and vibrant free enterprise system to provide the profits that they would then share in. And that was a very different from what happened in the United Kingdom and Western Europe, where labor unions were part and parcel of the socialist movement and were about the class, the working class as a whole, rather than just their members. So I think that helped inoculate America from the evils of socialism. It didn't inoculate it fully. We saw, for instance, in the Progressive Era, the creation of a whole raft of bureaucracies I believe will form the basis of a socialist state should socialists be elected to majority positions of power. And then we saw in the 1930s under the New Deal a sort of socialism light where government took a much stronger hand in deciding the how the economy of the nation should be should be conducted, but for quite some time, a sort of dual alliance of anti-socialist labor unions and strong and assertive businesses and industry helped keep socialism at bay. I think that one of the things that has changed in the most in recent years is that both those pillars have now collapsed.
Right. And you also deal with the idea of equality, and I think that this is part of the three groups you were talking about, and that one of the things that the socialists always argue is that, real socialism has never been tried. And you have an argument against that, and you bring in George Orwell, Doublethink, and you question the idea about whether inequality itself is a real problem. Can you expand on that for us?
Yes, I think one of the interesting things that a lot of people ask me when I start talking about socialism, well, how is it that people are ignorant of the history of socialism? How is it that they forget what happened in Eastern Europe? How is it they forget what happened in Western Europe and the repudiation of socialism there? How is it that people aren't paying attention to what's happening in Venezuela? And the answer to that is that socialism essentially has a sort of get out of jail free card. It was a colleague of mine in the UK, Dr. Christian Niemitz with the Institute of Economic Affairs in London, who first formulated this, the process by which this happens. And I strongly recommend anybody who's interested to look at his work. He noted that when socialist economies are set up, everybody, all the commentators say, yes, this is it. This is real socialism. We have real socialism at last. The new dawn is here. The international brotherhood of man is upon us. And then a few years later, when the internal contradictions of socialism start to bite and the wheels start to come off, then they turn around and say, well, this can't be the fault of socialism. Socialism is a perfect system. It must be the result of internal wreckers and saboteurs or foreign agents or the mm-hmm. CIA. That's where I think we are with Venezuela at the moment. Most of the democratic socialists of America will say that there's nothing wrong with Venezuela apart from the evil depredations of the CIA. And then finally, when everything has gone to heck in a handbasket, when the economy has completely collapsed, and in the worst cases, there may be many thousands dead, they turn around and say, no, no, that wasn't real socialism. Mm-hmm. And next time, we'll get it right. You know, the same, and it's the same people who cheered the appearance of real socialism at the beginning who then say, no, it wasn't real socialism. The same people who cheered the emergence of a strong man as a champion of the working class then say, no, no, he was a dictator, so he couldn't possibly have been socialist. And so socialism has this get-out-of-jail-free card, which basically means that any time socialism fails, it cannot be because of socialism. It's because it wasn't real socialism. So socialism has this... this ability to start from afresh, from a tabula rasa point of view, every time it gets tried.
That's the double think you're referring to, is it?
Absolutely. It's a very good example of the double think. Similarly, one of the internal contradictions of socialism that I mentioned is that the creation of a new ruling class, the creation of a new group of bureaucrats, commissars, apparatchiks, whatever you like to call them, who actually have a significant amount of power. And this is precisely because socialism claims to be democratic. Socialism says, all we want to do is to give the people control over the economy. How could you possibly object to that? Well, obviously, the people can't meet and vote and discuss on every aspect of the economy every hour of the day. So they have to delegate their power to somebody else, and that somebody else is bureaucrats. Those bureaucrats, of course, are... they are not Olympian gods, however much socialists would like you to think that they are. Socialists very often say, we just need to staff these bureaucracies with trained people. No amount of training gets over the fact that these people aren't gods. They are human beings just like the rest of us, and they have their own human failings, which means that they will... almost inevitably start to accrue to themselves power, bigger staffs, higher budgets, and the like, and start to use that power over the people that they are overseeing in the name of the people. So in the end, this new class, which has had this power delegated to it by the people, essentially becomes the new rulers of the people. So this is a different George Orwell story. This is Animal Farm, right, where you see the pigs take on the job of running the place, and in the end they appear on hind legs, and the old animal slogan of all animals are equal becomes all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others.
Yes, it's a very, very important and and good point you're making. It's as if socialism is almost this platonic ideal that exists in the world of the forms. And then when it comes down to our mundane world of the substances, it cannot be realized. And there's always some perversion. But as you say, the socialist advocates will blame some sort of outside forces, and then when things get bad, internal traitors, and that's when you start to kill off millions of citizens and whatnot, as almost inevitably happens in these cases. But you raise important ideas like why communist regimes are called democratic republics or people's democracies. It's a very different idea of the notion of democracy. But I'd like you to just expound on this. Is it an overlooked internal contradiction of socialism? Is there some necessary contradiction in socialism that for some reason people are blind to? They think it is this platonic ideal that is perfect, but they're missing something, and it almost inevitably comes up to the same story over and over again. And what is that blind spot that they miss that leads them to repeat the same processes over and over again?
Well, I think it's because the ideals of socialism seem intuitively right to many people. Mm-hmm. I think the people think, well, yes, it would be much better if we had the people, or even if we had trained experts looking over and after the economy. How can you possibly object to that? And this is where that process that I mentioned earlier comes in. There's an idealistic expectation that this time we're going to get it right. It's like the England football team always used to sing, "This time we're going to get it right. So we're going to win the World Cup." And they always go out in ignominious failure in the quarterfinal. It's this idealism that socialism that helps to allow for this get out of jail free card.
And would you put it down to that? It's just that there's a blind spot with regard to human nature that makes socialism fail. Because I don't know what it relies too much on humans to make the process work, and these humans then come and create other systems of inequality in its place. Would you say it's something like that that people keep forgetting?
Well, yes, I think that there's an important point here, which is that socialists generally come from the school of thought which believes it believes in the perfectibility of man, that man can somehow be perfected, whereas conservative schools of thought tend to believe in the idea of man as a fallen being who is full of sin and vice. The socialist says that no, these sins and vices are not inherent, and so can be trained out of people. And yet, to this day, we haven't found a society with a perfect man, although a lot of societies have tried.
Yes, that's right. It does get to, I suppose, down to these debates on human nature itself, and then even when people talk about the attack on religion that most socialist ideologies have, that then the state or the party or whatever group sort of substitutes as the god, that they substitute some sort of church worship or worship of a supreme being, and they put something else in its place, which is far more tyrannical in real life. Would you agree that is that part of your understanding of where this thing goes wrong?
Oh, indeed. I have a chapter on socialism and the divine in the Socialist Temptation. And one of the things that you note is that private religious organizations, religious associations, churches, and so on, one of the things that they do is that they provide public or social goods from a private source. But to the socialist, you know, the state is supposed to be the fountain origin of all these public or social goods. And so the churches and religious organizations are ultimately seen as a competitor. They can't possibly be coming from the same place as the state is. So therefore, they either have to be suppressed or taken over. Yeah, so in some socialist states, you see the church is allowed to continue, but is essentially subsumed to the state. And in other countries, you see the repudiation of these old ideas. You know, the Cultural Revolution in China, or Year Zero in Cambodia, being particularly appalling examples of it. But you see the attempts to drive these religious organizations completely out of the modern society.
Yeah, and then it takes on the character of its own type of sort of religious crusade, doesn't it? Like, you know, with the Cultural Revolution and trying to find the heretics and making them make public apologies and almost publicly burning them at the stake. It's very, very similar to a religious rivalry, isn't it?
Oh, indeed. But it's a particularly particularly suppressive form of religion. It demands atonement, but does not provide a path to forgiveness.
And we're
seeing that with what we call cancel culture today. This this idea that you cannot be forgiven for even the most momentary indiscretions of your youth in some cases. There is no way back for you unless you ascribe totally to the demands of the new thought.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to get to this question now about. I think you make a good case that socialism appeals very well and you know has a very highly developed polemic and. Rhetorical, set of weapons, if you want to put it that way, for addressing these values and equality, liberty, community, which is, I mean, sounds like the French Revolution, égalité, liberté, fraternité. But why, and as I was saying, on the right, there, especially the Reaganite and Thatcherite brands of it in the 1980s, they had dismissed any sort of attempt, certain wings of it, more the kind of Ayn Rand objectivist sort of wings. They dismissed any sort of appeal to such values at all, right? So you have that wing. That's not everybody. The paternalists, as you described, they, in some ways, not necessarily equality, but a sense of liberty and certainly community they had. But in general, the right has eschewed addressing these values. And I'll just give you a little story from my own experience. As I said, I grew up in Toronto and in this whole liberal environment and liberal education at the University of Toronto, and then where I did my master's in the West Indies at Jamaica. But when I did my PhD in the UK, Noel O'Sullivan was in my department, Lord Norton of Louth, and it was the first time I had ever been exposed to serious conservative thought, and the whole long tradition of European conservative thought. So not necessarily the Reagan Thatcher stuff, but you know, from Burke and a whole lot of European thought as well. And I was just, I was so angry when I discovered it. And I said, my whole life I was sort of deprived of this, you know, very exciting, interesting body of work. And it was part of a whole process of me reevaluating the right from what I saw. And I said, you know, it's not, you know, the right aren't necessarily greedy, evil people. To this day, that's the Democrat in the United States. That's the Democrat discourse. The Republicans are evil. They want to take away your health care. They want to kill old people. They hate black people. This is, you know, that this is the evil party. But for some reason, I don't think the right, the conservatives, attack that enough, and they sort of allow that critique to stick. Why do you think that is? Why don't they say, no, listen, if you really want equality or liberty or community, this, we offer it better. Why would you say that is?
I think you're completely right. I think this has been a fundamental mistake of the right, broadly put, to abandon this the
moral discourse,
language of values. To Margaret Thatcher was when the Labour Party would say the Conservative Party is a party of greed, she would respond by saying that the Labour Party was a party of envy. And mm-hmm. so she used that that moralistic tone, the language of sin, mm-hmm. to reflect back on the socialists of the time. We've forgotten how to do that, I think, and that's the negative sense. We've forgotten how to do, to make the positive case for conservatism and free enterprise in general. That there's been an over reliance on tradition, the idea that the current people are trying to destroy America appears to be the only sort of argument that's being advanced on the right. There is no outside a few economists such as my friend Steve Horvitz at Ball State University. There have been very few attempts to construct a positive case for the free market, for the free market and free enterprise, as being essential to the creation of community, to being essential to the reduction in violence and exploitation, and as being fundamental to an increase in the general welfare. We've forgotten how to use those arguments and that language, and until we do, I think we're always going to be playing on the back foot.
Yes, you know, I remember looking at the right and left. I was kind of more in the 80s in the kind of libertarian socialist tradition, right? And then when they looked at the radical free market right, so radical libertarian, I realized, you know, the goals aren't that different. You know, they are both sort of anti-monopoly, anti-huge corporations, anti-huge government. It's just that one might believe in private property in the free market a little more, the other would believe in voluntarism and community. But they are not that far off. And sometimes we see now in the current context, you see among libertarians and progressives, they might also share some values which are, maybe anti-war, anti-corporate monopolies. And So there's this interesting sharing of perspectives that crosses the line, and I was just and then you also see it on the other side, like for instance the way the kind of big corporate Democrats and the corporate Republicans in the United States have very, very similar policies. And in fact, you know, you see, you know, right-wing governments, you know, whether it be Republicans or conservatives, embracing things like quantitative easing, and especially during this coronavirus time, massive, massive government spending and whatnot. This is, you do mention in your last, you know, afterward, because I think, you know, the bulk of this would have been definitely written before the coronavirus time, but certainly with coronavirus and the lockdowns, the sort of intensification of a lot of these socialist ideas seems to have been growing. Can you comment on those things?
Well, yes, I think it's extremely unfortunate that that the first reaction of the of both sides when the coronavirus hit was essentially how much money can we spend, and mm-hmm. not you know the as my colleague Wayne Cruz says, you know, what comes after a trillion, you know, how much more are we going to spend in a vain attempt just to keep the patient still breathing, rather than you know, actually getting the patient up and out again. You know, the fact that after the coronavirus hit, governors and mayors around the United States, and then eventually the federal government followed suit, found no fewer than 800 regulations that they needed to get rid of in order to keep the economy going, suggests that these regulations were never actually needed in the first place. And the fact that there hasn't been a genuine push for a deregulatory title to a coronavirus relief bill just astonishes me. The idea that the people might be able to get the economy going again if government just got out of the way doesn't seem to be part of the national discourse at the moment. And if that is how it does play out, then I'm afraid we're going to see a much bigger government in all areas of life, municipal, state, and federal, than there was before the coronavirus, and there was no need for it.
Yeah, I mean, it really is something, because it's conservative governments and Republican governments that are actually implementing it. And some people have noted that, you know, things like, you know, say on the cultural front, like maybe, you know, gay marriage and so forth, many times it's conservative parties that have actually implemented it. And so a lot of things that are implemented by conservative governments today in the 70s or 80s would have been seen as far left. And there are some people who have argued that, you know, the right has you know, lost the war. The Overton window keeps being pushed farther and farther left. And what was considered far left at one time is now right wing, and what was considered and now what is considered left gets more and more radical. Do you agree with this? And where do you see, and if so, do you see where do you see the drive towards, you know, a renewed, you know, socialist resurgence with the socialism temptation you're talking about going? How do you see it moving in future?
Well, I think this is right. And I say in the book at one point that we can't just keep allowing governments to chip away at liberty. Liberty is important, There are times when you're going to have to say that whatever the supposed benefit of this new policy is, it will reduce liberty. It's time to stand up for liberty for its own sake and say, no, we can't do this. In fact, what we should be doing is expanding liberty rather than reducing it. Unfortunately, there is, at least in American politics at the moment, there is a feeling that liberty is only those, and this is from people who are supposedly believers in liberty. Liberty is only those words which are contained within the U.S. Constitution. Of course, the U.S. Constitution actually has a phrase to the effect that there are many other liberties which need to be retained by the people. But that room for expansion of liberty is generally forgotten about. And we need leaders who are willing to stand up and fight for liberty in its broadest sense. Otherwise, I think you're right that we will have socialism imposed by nominally conservative leaders rather than by actual socialist ones.
Yeah. Well, let's wrap up the interview, move toward a conclusion. I've had you here a long time, and I know your time is limited. But what message would you like to leave your readers with after reading this book?
I would hope that the people would realize that socialism is just so full of contradictions. That in the end it shouldn't be part of our national discourse. It should be consigned to the dustbin of history, where it seemed to be for a good decade or so. But I'd also like people to think about what we were just talking about how if we're going to win the battle for the hearts and minds, especially of younger people, that we need to talk in terms of values. We need to make our messages not in the language of economics or history or GDP or the stock market or something. We need to talk in terms of those values. We need to talk about how markets are sources of peace and mutual understanding, and that we interfere with that process at our peril. So those are the two main messages that I would like people to leave reading the book with.
Very good. And are you working on anything right now? Anything else? Where can people find your work and take a look at what you, because you've also done a lot of things in the past as well. This is by no means your first. Where can they find you and what might you be working on now that you would like our audience to know about?
Well, my day job is at the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. You can find us on the web at cei.org, and also on Twitter at cei.org, all one word. We work primarily on regulatory issues, and we actually currently have a campaign called Never Needed, which is pushing for further deregulation in response to the coronavirus outbreak. And I would hope that the people, if they go to cei.org and go to neverneeded.cei.org, then they will see a lot there, a lot of work that we're doing there that might spark some ideas and sympathy.
Well, thanks so much for this interview. It's been very informative and enjoyable.
I have very much enjoyed it as well. Thank you.
Well, once again, the book is The Socialist Temptation, published by Regenery Gateway, and it's out now in hardcover and on Kindle. And we've been speaking to the author, Ian Murray. Thank you also to you, our listeners. I look forward to seeing you on the next episode.